sister, and ruffling their hair affectionately. We just got back. Don't give Helen a hard time. Well, she doesn't have to make breakfast, said Drew. We could make our own. Helen hurried over to the plate of toast and set it on the table. Drew stared at it blankly. Come on, Drew, she said. Just eat the bread. Drew stiffened all over. Don't tell me what to eat and not eat, she said. Helen flinched. Tavi reached for the jam and upended it, shaking it until sticky jelly splattered all over his plate, the table in his hands. He giggled.
Don't, no,
Helen said, grabbing the jam out of his hands.
Tavi, don't do that.
I don't have to listen to you, Tavi said, his small face flushing. I don't even know you. He pushed his way past Drew and bolted from the kitchen. After a moment, Drew shot Helen a reproachful look and darted after him. Helen stood where she was, holding the empty plastic jam jar, tears running down her face. Christina's heart went out to her. All she wanted was to please her little siblings, but they couldn't forgive her for not being Julian. She moved toward Helen, but Mark was already there, putting his arms around his sister, getting jam on his shirt.
It's all right, Christina heard him say. When I first got back, I was always messing things up. I got everything wrong.
Feeling like an intruder, Christina slipped out of the kitchen. Some family scenes were private. She headed down the hall slowly. She was sure there was a second coffee maker in the library. Half her mind was on what Mark had said to Helen, that when he first returned to the Institute, he had messed everything up. She wondered if he really felt that way. She remembered the first time she'd seen him, crouched against the wall of his bedroom as the wind blew the curtains around him like sails. The bond she had felt with him had been immediate. She hadn't known him before the hunt had taken him, and had no expectations of what he was like or who he should be. It had tied them together as strongly as the binding spell. But what if everything had changed? What if what they had was broken and could never be repaired?
Christina!
She spun around. Mark was behind her, flushed. He'd been running to catch up to her. He stopped when she turned and hesitated for a moment, looking like someone about to take a step off a high cliff.
I have to be with Helen now, he said. But I need to talk to you. I've needed to talk to you since... for a long time. Meet me in the parking lot tonight, when the moon is high.
She nodded, too surprised to say anything. By the time it occurred to her that when the moon is high wasn't very helpful, what if it was cloudy, he'd already vanished down the hall. With a sigh, she headed off to send Katerina Loss a fire message. It had only been a few days since Robert Lightwood's death, but Horace Dearborn had already completely redecorated his office. The first thing Emma noticed was that the tapestry of the Battle of the Burren was missing. The fireplace was lit now, and over it Alec Lightwood's image had been replaced by Zara Dearborn's. It was a portrait of her in gear, her long blonde brown hair falling to her waist in two braids like a Viking's. Zara Dearborn, Clave Hero, set a gold plaque on the frame.
Subtle, Julian muttered.
He and Emma had just come into Horace's office. The Inquisitor was bent over and poking around in his desk, seemingly ignoring them. The desk, at least, was the same, though a large sign hung behind it that announced, "Purity is strength, strength is victory, therefore purity is victory." Dearborn straightened up.
"Clave Hero might be a bit simple," he said thoughtfully, making it quite clear he'd heard Julian's comment. "I was thinking modern Boadicea, in case you don't know who she was."
"I know who Boadicea was," said Julian, seating himself. Emma followed.
The chairs were new as well, with stiff upholstery. "A warrior queen of Britain."
"Julian's uncle was a classical scholar," said Emma.
"Ah, yes, so Zara told me."
Horace dropped heavily into his own seat, behind the mahogany desk. He was a big man, raw-boned, with a nondescript face. Only his size was unusual. His hands were enormous, and his big shoulders pulled at the material of his uniform. They must not have had time to make one up for him yet.
Now, children, I must say I'm surprised at you two. There has always been such a vibrant partnership between the Blackthorn and Carstairs families and the Clave.
The Clave has changed, said Emma.
Not all change is for the worse, said Horace. This has been a long time coming.
Julian swung his feet up, planting his boots on Horace's desk. Emma blinked. Julian had always been rebellious at heart, but rarely openly. He smiled like an angel and said,
Why don't you just tell us what you want?
Horace's eyes glinted. There was anger in them, but his voice was smooth when he spoke.
You two have really fucked up, he said. More than you know.
Emma was jolted. Shadowhunter adults, especially those in positions of authority, rarely swore in front of anyone they considered children. What do you mean? She said. He opened a desk drawer and took out a black leather notebook.
Robert Lightwood's notes, he said.
He took them after every meeting he had. He took them after the meeting he had with you.
Julian went white. He clearly recognized the notebook. Robert must have written in it after Emma left his office with Manuel.
So Julian can still feel fear and surprise, Emma thought, even as her mind raced. What had Robert written down?
I know what you told him about your relationship, Dearborn said with relish. Parabatai in love. Disgusting. And I know what you wanted from him. Exile.
Though the color had left his face, Julian's voice was steady.
I still think you should tell us what you want from us.
To fall in love with your parabatai is, shall we say, a breach of contract. The contract you made as Nephilim, with the Clave. It desecrates our holiest of holy bonds.
He set the notebook back in its drawer.
But I am not an unreasonable man. I've come up with a mutually beneficial solution to all our little problems, and a few of the big ones.
Solutions aren't usually mutually beneficial when one party has all the power, said Julia.
Dearborn ignored him.
If you agree to be sent on a mission to the land of Faerie, if you promise to find and kill Annabel Blackthorn there, and bring back the black volume of the dead. I'll honor the terms Robert set out. Exile and secrecy. No one will ever know.
You can't be sure she's in Faerie, Julian began.
You have got to be kidding, Emma said at the same time. My sources say she's in the Unseelie Court, and no, I am not kidding, said Dearborn. I would swear on it on the mortal sword if Carstairs hadn't broken it.
Emma flushed.
Why do you want the Black Volume? Planning on raising some dead?
I have no interest in some warlock's pitiable book of necromantic amusements, said Horace,
save keeping it out of the hands of Annabel Blackthorn and the King of Unseelie. Do not even consider trying to fob me off with imitations or fakes. I will know, and I will punish you. I want the Black Volume in the control of Nephilim. Not downworlders.
You must have older, more capable people who can do this, said Julian.
This mission must be carried out with the utmost secrecy, Dearborn snapped.
Who has a better reason to keep it a secret than you?
But time works differently in Faerie, said Julian. We could wind up coming back 10 years from now. That won't help you much.
Ah, Dearborn sat back. There was a pile of cloth behind him. In one corner of the room,
Emma realized with a jolt that it was the tapestry of the Battle of the Burren, thrown away like so much trash. Strange for a man who claimed to value Nephilim history.
A long time ago, 3 medallions were given to the Clave by the fair folk. They prevent time slippage in Faerie. One is missing, but you'll be given one of the remaining two. You can return it when you yourselves come back.
A medallion? Emma remembered Christina's necklace, its power to control time in Faerie. One of them is missing.
And how are we supposed to get back? Emma said. It's not as if returning from Faerie is easy for a human.
You will use the map we give you to locate a place called Brahm's Crossroads, said Horace. There you will find a friend ready to bring you home.
He steepled his fingers together. I will conceal the fact that you are not in Alicante by placing guards around the Prince Waterhouse. The word will be that you are under house arrest until the matter of the mortal sword is cleared up.
But I must insist that you find the book and return within 4 days. Otherwise, I may assume you decided to strike out on your own, in which case I will have no choice but to reveal your secret.
What makes you think we can do this in 4 days? Said Julian.
Because you have no choice, Horace said.
Emma exchanged a look with Julian. She suspected his feelings, such as they were, mirrored her own, suspicion and helplessness. They couldn't trust Horace Dearborn, but if they didn't agree to his plan, he would destroy their lives. Their marks would be stripped. They would never see the other Blackthorns again.
There's no need for you to look so untrusting, said Dearborn. We are in this together. None of us want Annabel Blackthorne or the Unseelie King to possess such a powerful item as the Black Volume.
He gave a yellowish smile.
Besides, Julian, I thought you'd be pleased. This is your chance to kill Annabel Blackthorne and take a precious book from her. I would have thought you'd want revenge.
Unable to bear the way the Inquisitor was looking at Julian, Emma stood up.
I want Cortana, she said. It was my father's before mine, and it has belonged in my family since before Jem and Cordelia Carstairs. Give it back to me.
No, Horace said, his thin mouth flattening. We are still investigating how it managed to shatter the mortal sword. We will furnish you with weapons, food, a map, and all the gear you need, but not Cortana.
Seraph blades don't work in Faerie, said Julian. Neither will our runes.
Dearborn snorted.
Then you'll be given daggers and swords and crossbows. You know we have every weapon you might need.
He rose to his feet.
I don't care what you use to kill Annabel Blackthorne. Just kill her. You brought that bitch to us. It's your responsibility to rid us of her.
Julian slid his boots off the desk.
When are we supposed to be leaving?
And how will we get there? Said Emma. That's for me to know, said Dearborn. As for when you leave, it might as well be now. It's not as if you have anything you need to be doing in Alicante.
He gestured toward the door, as if he couldn't wait to be rid of them.
Go home and retrieve whatever personal items you require, and don't waste time. Guards will be coming to get you shortly. Be ready.
Fine, Emma said.
She strode over to the corner and picked up the tapestry of Alec. But I'm keeping this. It was surprisingly heavy. Dearborn raised his eyebrows but said nothing as she staggered out of the room, clutching it.
Where are we going? Kit said.
He was holding the bag of potato chips, salt and grease on his fingers. It was a weird breakfast, but he'd had weirder in his life. Besides, the ocean breeze was lifting his hair off his forehead. The beach was deserted, and he and Ty were walking into a golden haze of sand and sunshine. Despite everything, his mood was lifting.
Remember that cave? Ty said. The one we were in when we saw Zara talking to Manuel?
Yeah, Kit said, and almost added, when we were with Libby, but he knew that was what Ty meant by we. It was a word that for him would always include Livy. The shadow of memory fell over Kit's good mood. He remembered that night. Livy laughing. Ty holding up a starfish. The salt air had tangled his usually straight hair, and his eyes had echoed the silver color of the moon. He had been smiling, his real,
shining tie smile.
Kit had felt closer to the two of them than he had ever felt to anyone else.
Wait, why are we going there?
They had reached the part of the beach where long fingers of pocked granite reached out into the ocean. The waves rushed in from the sea, slamming against the rocks, whipping themselves up into white-silver spray. Ty reached into the bag of chips, his arm brushing against Kit's. Because we need help to do necromancy, we can't do it on our own.
Please tell me we don't need help from an army of the dead. I hate armies of the dead.
Not an army of the dead. Hypatia Vex.
Kit nearly dropped the chips. Hypatia Vex? The warlock from London?
Yep, said Ty.
Keep up, Watson.
That's not a keep up, said Kit.
How would I know you contacted her? I didn't think she liked this very much.
Does it matter?
You make a good point.
Kit stopped, sand kicking up around his sneakers.
Here we are.
A dark hole in the bluff opened up in front of them. Ty paused too, rooting around in the pocket of his hoodie.
I have something for you.
Kit rolled up the bag of chips and stashed it behind a rock.
You do?
Ty produced a small white stone, about the size of a golf ball, with a rune etched into it.
Your Witchlight rune stone. Every shadow hunter has one.
He took Kit's hand unselfconsciously and pressed the stone into his palm. A hot flutter went through Kit's stomach, surprising him. He never felt anything like it before.
Thanks, he said. How do I activate it?
Close your fingers around it and think of light, said Ty. Imagine a light switch flicking on. That's what Julian said to me. Come on, I'll show you. Kit held the stone awkwardly as they headed up the path to the cave entrance. A few steps into the cave, and the darkness enveloped them, like velvet, muffling the sound of the waves outside. Kit could barely see Ty, the shadow of a shadow beside him.
Like flicking a switch, he thought, and closed his fingers around the runestone.
It gave a little kick in his palm, and light rayed out, illuminating the familiar stone corridor. It was much as it had been before, rough-walled and spidery, reminding Kit of the underground tunnels in the first Indiana Jones movie. At least this time they knew where they were going. They followed the curve of the tunnel around a bend into an enormous stone chamber. The walls were granite, though black lines scored through them showed where they had cracked long ago. The room smelled like something sweet, probably the smoke that rose from the candles placed on the wooden table in the room's center. A hooded figure in a black robe, its face lost in shadow, sat where Zara had been sitting the last time they'd been here.
Hypatia, said Ty, stepping forward. The figure raised a single, silencing finger. Both Kit and Ty hesitated as two gloved hands rose to push back the enveloping hood.
Ty licked his dry lips.
You're not Hypatia,
he turned to Kit. That's not her.
No, Kit agreed. Seems to be a green fellow with horns.
I'm not Hypatia, but she did send me, said the warlock. We have met before, the three of us, in the shadow market in London.
Kit remembered quickly moving green-tented hands.
I have to say, I never thought I'd have the pleasure of entertaining the lost Herondale.
Shade, he said.
The warlock looked amused. Not my real name, but it'll do.
Ty was shaking his head.
I want to deal with Hypatia, he said, not you.
Shade leaned back in his chair.
Most warlocks won't touch necromancy, he said quietly. Hypatia isn't any different. In fact, she's smarter than most. She wants to run the shadow market herself one day, and she's not going to endanger her chances.
Ty's expression seemed to splinter like the cracked face of a statue.
I never said anything about necromancy.
Your twin sister just died, said Shade, and you reach out to a warlock with a desperate request. Doesn't take a genius to guess what you want.
Kit put a hand on Ty's shoulder. We don't have to stay here, he said. We can just leave.
No, said Shade. Hear me out first, little shadow hunters, if you wish for my help. I understand. Grief makes people mad. You search for a way to end it.
Yes, said Ty. I want to bring my sister back. I will bring my sister back.
Shade's dark eyes were flinty. You want to raise the dead. Do you know how many people want to do that? It's not a good plan. I suggest you drop it.
I could help you out with something else. Have you ever wanted to move objects with your mind?
Sure, said Kit. That sounds great.
Anything but this.
I have the black volume of the dead, said Ty. Or at least, I have a copy.
He didn't seem to recognize the absolute astonishment on Shade's face, but Kit saw it. It increased both his pride in Ty and, at the same time, his apprehension.
Well, said Shade finally, that's better than the real thing.
Odd thing to say, Kit thought.
So it's not the spells we need help with, said Ty. We need your help in gathering spell components. Some are easy to get, but shadow hunters aren't welcome at the shadow market. So, if you could go, I could give you money, or we have a lot of valuable weapons in the Institute.
Kit was pleased. I thought about selling those once myself.
Shade held up his gloved hands.
No, he said. I'll help you, all right. But it won't be fast, and it won't be easy.
Good, said Ty. But Kit was instantly suspicious.
Why, said Kit. Why would you help us? You don't approve.
I don't, said Shade. But if it isn't me, it'll be someone else. Some other warlock with fewer scruples.
At least I can make sure you do this as cleanly as possible. I can show you how to cast the spell properly. I can get you a catalyst, a clean energy source that won't corrupt what you do.
But you won't go to the shadow market, said Kit.
The spell only works if the spellcaster collects the components themselves, said Shade. And you'll be the one casting this spell, even if you need me to direct you. So whatever is between you two and the people of the shadow market, and I saw some of it myself, so I know it's personal, clean it up. His voice was gruff. You're clever, you can figure it out. When you've got what you need, come back to me. I'll remain here in the cave for as long as you're committed to this insane project. But send a note if you're planning on dropping by. I like my privacy.
Ty's face was alight with relief, and Kit knew what he was thinking. This was one step accomplished, one move closer to getting Livy back. Shade looked at him and shook his head, his white hair gleaming in the candlelight.
Of course, if you reconsider, and if I never hear from you again, that will be even better, he added.
Consider this, children. Some lights were never meant to burn for long. He closed his gloved fingers around the wick of the largest candle, extinguishing it. A plume of white smoke rose toward the ceiling. Kit glanced at Ty again, but he hadn't reacted. He might not have even heard Shade. He was smiling to himself. Not the blazing smile Kit had missed on the beach, but a quiet, private smile. If we go forward, I have to shoulder this alone, Kit thought. Any guilt, any apprehension. It's only mine. He glanced away from the warlock before Shade could see the doubt in his eyes. Sunlights were never meant to burn for long.
I can't believe the Centaurians left such a mess, Helen said.
For years, Helen had promised Aline that she would take her on a full tour of the Institute and show her all her favorite places from her childhood. But Helen's mind was only partly on showing Aline around. Some of it was on the destruction wrought by the Centaurians inside the Institute. Towels left everywhere, stains on the tables,
and old food rotting in the fridge in the kitchen. Some of it was on the message she'd paid a ferry to take to her Aunt Neen in the Sealy Court, but most of it was on her family. "Those jerks aren't what's really bothering you," said Aline. They were standing on an overlook some distance from the Institute. From here you could see the desert, carpeted with wildflowers and green scrub, and the ocean as well, blue and gleaming below. There had been ocean at Wrangell Island, cold and icy and beautiful, but in no way welcoming. This was the sea of Helen's childhood. The sea of long days spent splashing in the waves with her sisters and brothers.
"You can tell me anything, Helen."
"They hate me," Helen said in a small voice.
"Who hates you?" Aline demanded. "I'll kill them."
"My brothers and sister," said Helen. "Please don't kill them, though." Aline looked stunned.
"What do you mean, they hate you?"
"Ty ignores me," said Helen. "Drew snarls at me. Tavi despises that I'm not Julian. And Mark, well, Mark doesn't hate me, but his mind seems far away. I can't drag him into this." Aline crossed her arms and stared thoughtfully at the ocean. This was one of the things Helen loved about her wife. If Helen said something was the case, Aline would consider it from all angles. She was never dismissive.
"I told Julian to tell all the kids I was happy on Wrangell Island," said Helen. "I didn't want them to worry, but now I think they believe I spent all those years not caring about being separated from them. They don't know how much I miss them. They don't know how horrible I feel that Julian had to shoulder all that responsibility for all those years. I didn't know."
"The thing is," said Aline, "they don't just see you as replacing Julian as the person who takes care of them. You also stepped into their lives just as Livy left them."
"But I also loved Livy. I also miss her."
"I know," Aline said gently. "But they're just children. They're grief-stricken and lashing out. They don't know this is why they feel angry. They just feel it."
"I can't do this."
Helen tried to keep her voice steady, but it was nearly impossible. She hoped the strain would be covered by the sound of the waves crashing below them, but Aline knew her too well. She could sense when Helen was upset, even when she was trying hard not to show it.
"It's too hard."
"Baby," Aline moved closer, wrapping her arms around Helen, crushing her lips softly with her own. "You can. You can do anything." Helen relaxed into her wife's arms. When she'd first met Aline, she thought the other girl was taller than she was. But she'd realized later it was the way Aline held herself, arrow straight. The consul, her mother, held herself the same way, and with the same pride. Not that either of them was arrogant, but the words seemed a shade closer to what Helen imagined than simple confidence. She remembered the first love note Aline had ever written her. "The world is changed because you are made of ivory and gold. The curves of your lips rewrite history." Later she'd found out it was an Oscar Wilde quote, and had said to Aline, smiling, "You have got a lot of nerve." Aline had looked back at her steadily.
"I know. I do."
They both had, always, and it had stood them in good stead. But this wasn't a situation where nerve mattered so much as patience. Helen had expected her younger brothers and sister to love her. She had needed it, in a way. Now she realized she had to show them her love first. "In a way, their anger means good things," said Aline. "It means they know you'll always love them, no matter what. Eventually they'll stop testing you." "Is there any way to speed up eventually? Would thinking about it as someday help?" Helen sniffled a laugh. "No." Aline stroked her hair gently. "It was worth a try." There were a dozen or more guards posted when Emma and Julian returned to the house. It was a bright day, and sun sparkled off the swords slung over their shoulders in the water in the canal. As they went up the stairs, Dane Larkspear was slouching against one side of the doorway, his whippety face pale under a shock of black hair. He winked at Emma as Julian, ignoring him, reached for his steely.
"Nice to see you."
"Can't say the same," said Emma. "Where's your evil twin? And I mean that literally. She's your twin, and she's evil."
"Yeah, I got that," said Dane, rolling his eyes. "Samantha's at the Scholomance, and you've got guests."
Emma tensed. "In the house? Isn't the point of guards to keep them out?" Dane chuckled.
"Please, the point of us is to keep you in."
Julian scrawled an unlocking rune on the door and gave Dane a dark look.
15 against 2?
Dane's smirk got wider.
"Just showing you who's in power," he said. "We control the odds. I don't feel bad about that at all."
"You wouldn't," Julian said and stalked into the house.
"Just in case I wasn't feeling really crappy about this situation already," Emma muttered and followed Julian.
She was wary. She hadn't liked the way Dane had said the word guests. She closed the front door slowly, hand on the hilt of the dagger in her weapons belt. She heard Julian call her name.
"In the kitchen," he said. "It's all right, Emma."
Usually she trusted Julian more than she trusted herself, but things were different now. She went carefully toward the kitchen, only dropping her hand from the dagger when she saw Isabel seated on the kitchen table, her long legs crossed. She was wearing a short velvet coat and a long tulle skirt. The bright glint of silver jewelry shone on her wrists and ankles. Simon was sitting on one of the kitchen chairs, elbows on the table, sunglasses pushed up on his head.
"Hope you don't mind," he said. "The guards let us in."
"Not at all," said Julian, leaning against one of the counters. "I'm just surprised they agreed."
"Friendly persuasion," said Isabel, and smiled a smile that was mostly teeth.
"The cohort doesn't have all the power yet. We still know a lot of people in high places."
"Where were you?" Simon inquired. "The guards wouldn't tell us anything."
"The Inquisitor wanted to talk to us," said Emma.
Simon frowned.
"Dearborn? You mean he wanted to interrogate you?"
"Not exactly."
Emma took off her jacket and slung it over a chair back.
"He had a favor he wanted us to do. But what are you doing here?"
Isabel and Simon exchanged a glance.
"We have some bad news," Simon said.
Emma stared harder at both of them. Izzy looked tired, Simon tense, but that wasn't surprising. She could only imagine how she looked herself.
"My brothers and sisters," Julian began, his voice tight,
and Emma glanced at him. She remembered what he'd said about climbing up the pyre after Ty. It was atavistic, the need to protect him. There was no conscious thought to it.
"Nothing like that," said Simon.
"Jace and Clary didn't come back at the appointed time."
Speechless, Emma sank into the chair opposite Simon.
"That's interesting," Julian said. "What do you think happened?"
Simon looked at him oddly. Isabel nudged him with her knee, and through her surprise and worry, Emma heard her mutter something about how Julian's sister just died and he was probably still in shock.
"Maybe they're just late because of the time being different in Faerie," said Emma. "Or did they get one of the medallions?"
"They're not affected by the time magic in Faerie because of their angel blood," said Isabel. "That's why the Clave chose to send them. Their runes still work, even in the Blighted Lands."
She frowned. "What medallions?"
"Oh," Emma exchanged a look with Julian. "The Clave has medallions that prevent time slippage in Faerie. Dearborn gave us one."
Isabel and Simon exchanged a bewildered glance.
"What? Why would they give you—"
"The favor Dearborn asked us to do," said Julian. "It involved traveling to Faerie."
Simon straightened up. His face had gone tight-jawed in a way that reminded Emma that he wasn't just Isabel Lightwood's mild-mannered fiancé. He was a hero in his own right. He'd face down the angel Raziel himself. Few besides Clary could say that.
"He did what?"
I'll explain, said Julian, and he did, with a dry economy uncolored by emotion. Nevertheless, when he was done, both Isabel and Simon looked furious.
How dare he, said Simon. How can he think, but he's the Inquisitor now?
He'd know Jason Clary haven't come back, interrupted Isabel. The Clave knows it's dangerous, especially now. Why would he send you?
Because Annabelle escaped into Faerie, and he thinks Annabelle is our problem, said Emma.
It's ridiculous. You guys are just kids, Simon said.
Isabel kicked him lightly. We did a lot when we were kids.
Because we had to, said Simon. Because we had no choices.
He turned back to Emma and Julian.
We can get you out of here. We can hide you.
No, Julian said.
He means that we don't have choices either, said Emma. There's too much chance of the Black Volume being put to terrible use, either by Annabelle or the Unseelie King. There's no telling who might get hurt, and we have the best chance of finding the book. No one else has dealt with Annabelle for centuries. In a weird way, Julian knows her the best.
And we can look for Jason Clary. It's not like Horace is going to send anyone else to find them, said Julian.
Isabel looked flinty. Because he's a jerk, you mean?
Because he doesn't like the support they have, or the way people look up to them, and Alec and you guys, said Julian. The longer they're gone, the better for him. He wants to consolidate power. He doesn't need heroes coming back. I'm sure Gia would try to help, but he won't make it easy for her. He can always throw delays in her path.
Julian was very pale, and his eyes looked like the blue sea glass in his bracelet. Her parabatai might not be feeling anything himself, Emma thought, but he still understood other people's feelings almost too well. He had made the one argument Simon and Isabel wouldn't be able to push back against, Clary and Jace's safety. Still, Simon tried.
We can figure out something ourselves, he said. Some way to look for them. The offer to hide you still stands.
They'll take it out on my family if I disappear, Julian said. This is a new Clave.
Or maybe just what was always hiding under the old one, said Emma. Can you swear you won't tell anyone, not even Gia, about us going to Faerie?
No one can know. If Gia confronts Horace, he'll tell her our secret.
Simon and Isabel looked troubled, but they both promised.
When are they asking you to leave? Said Isabel.
Soon, said Julian. We just came back here to pack our things.
Simon muttered a curse. Isabel shook her head, then bent down and unclipped a chain from one slender ankle. She held it out to Emma.
This is blessed iron, poisonous to fairies. Wear it and you can pack a hell of a kick.
Thanks. Emma took the chain and wrapped it twice around her wrist, fastening it tightly.
Do I have anything iron?
Simon looked around wildly, then reached into his pocket and pulled out a small miniature figure of an archer.
This is my D&D character, Lord Montgomery.
Oh, my God, said Isabel.
Most figurines are pewter, but this one's iron.
I got it on Kickstarter. Simon held it out to Julian. Just take it. Could be helpful.
I don't understand half of what you just said, but thanks, said Julian, pocketing the toy.
There was an awkward silence. It was Isabel who broke it, her dark gaze passing from Julian to Emma and back again.
Thank you, she said. Both of you. This is an incredibly brave thing to do.
She took a deep breath. When you find Clary and Jace, and I know you will, tell Jace about Robert. He should know what's happened to his family.
Chapter 7 Stone Flowers. Thankfully, there were no clouds. It was a clear California night, with a warm wind blowing inland from the desert, and the moon was bright and very definitely high in the sky, when Christina slipped out the back door of the Institute and hesitated on the top step. It had been an odd evening. Helen and Aline had made spaghetti and left the pot on the stove so anyone who liked could come along and serve themselves. Christina had eaten with Kit and Ty, who were bright-eyed and distant, caught up in their own world. At some point, Drew had come in with bowls and put them in the sink. "I had dinner with Tavi in his room," she'd announced, and Christina, feeling completely at sea, had stammered something about how she was glad they'd eaten. Mark hadn't appeared at all. Christina had waited until midnight before putting on a dress and a denim jacket and going to see Mark. It was strange to have her own clothes back. Her room, with its arbol de vida, her own sheets and blankets. It wasn't quite coming home, but it was close. She paused at the top of the stairs. In the distance, the waves swayed and crashed. She'd stood here once and watched as Kieran and Mark kissed each other, Kieran holding Mark as if he were everything in the world. It felt like a long time ago now. She moved down the steps, the wind catching at the hem of her pale yellow dress, making it bell out like a flower. The parking lot was really a large rectangle of raked sand where the Institute's car spent its time. At least the Centaurians didn't seem to have set it on fire, which was something. Near the lot were statues of Greek and Roman philosophers and playwrights, glowing palely under the stars, placed there by Arthur Blackthorne. They seemed out of place in the scrubby chaparral of the Malibu Hills. "Lady of Roses," said a voice behind her. "Kieran," she thought and turned. And of course it wasn't Kieran. It was Mark. Tousled pale blonde hair and blue jeans and a flannel shirt, which he'd buttoned slightly wrong. The Markness of him made her flush, partly at his nearness and partly that she'd thought for a moment that he might be someone else. It was just that Kieran was the only one who called her Lady of Roses. "I cannot bear all this iron," Mark said, and he sounded more tired than she had ever heard anyone sound. "I cannot bear these inside spaces, and I have missed you so much. Will you come into the desert with me?" Christina remembered the last time they were in the desert, and what he had said. He had touched her face. "Am I imagining you? I was thinking about you, and now here you are." Fairies couldn't lie. But Mark could. And yet it was his painful honesty that caught at Christina's heart. "Of course I will," she said. He smiled, and it lit up his face. He cut across the parking lot, Christina beside him, following a nearly invisible trail between tangled scrub and fern-shrouded boulders. "I used to walk here all the time when I was younger," he said, "before the dark war. I used to come here to think about my problems, brood about them, whatever you want to call it."
"What problems?" she teased.
"Romantic ones?" He laughed. "I never really dated anyone back then," he said. "Vanessa Ashdown for about a week, but just, well, she wasn't very nice. Then I had a crush on a boy who was in the Conclave, but his family moved back to Idris after the Mortal War, and now I don't remember his name."
"Oh, dear," she said. "Do you look at boys in Idris now and think, that might be him?"
"He'd be 20 now," said Mark. "For all I know, he's married and has a dozen children."
"At 20?"
said Christina. "He'd have had to have been having triplets every year for 4 years."
"Or two sets of sextuplets," said Mark. "It could happen."
They were both laughing now, softly, in the way of people who were just glad to be with each other.
"I missed you," he had said, and for a moment Christina let herself forget the past days and be happy to be with Mark in the beautiful night. She had always loved the stark lines of deserts, the gleaming tangles of sagebrush and thorn bushes, the massive shadows of mountains in the distance, the smell of sugar pines and incense cedar, the golden sand turned silver by moonlight. As they reached the flat top of the steep-sided hill, the ground fell away below them, and she could see the ocean in the distance, its wind-touched shimmer reaching to the horizon in a dream of silver and black.
"This is one of my favorite places,"
Mark sank down onto the sand, leaning back on his hands. The Institute and the highway are hidden, and the whole world goes away. It's just you in the desert. She sat down beside him. The sand was still warm from the sunlight it had absorbed during the day. She dug her toes in, glad she'd worn sandals.
Is this where you used to do your thinking?
He didn't answer.
He seemed to have become absorbed in looking at his own hands. They were scarred lightly, all over, calloused like any shadow hunter's, his voyance rune stark on his right hand.
It's all right, she said. It's all right for you not to be able to stand the iron, or inside spaces, or closed rooms, or the sight of the ocean, or anything at all. Your sister just died. There is nothing you could feel that would be wrong.
His chest hitched with an uneven breath.
What if I told you? If I told you that I am grieving for my sister. But since I 5 years ago decided she was dead, that all my family was dead, that I have already grieved her, in a way. That my grief is different than the grief of the rest of my family. And therefore, I cannot talk to them about it. I lost her, and I gained her, and lost her again. It is more as if the having of her was a brief dream. It might be that it is easier to think of it that way, she said. When I lost Jaime, though it is not the same, but when he disappeared and our friendship ended, I grieved for him despite my anger. And then I began to wonder sometimes if perhaps I had dreamed him. No one else spoke of him, and I thought perhaps he had never existed. She drew up her knees, locking her arms around them. And then I came here, and no one knew him at all. And it was even more as if he had never been.
Mark was looking at her now. He was silver and white in the moonlight. And so beautiful to her that her heart broke a little.
He was your best friend. He was going to be my parabatai.
So, you did not just lose him, Mark said. You lost that Christina, the one with the parabatai.
And you have lost that Mark, she said, the one who was Livia's brother.
His smile was wry. You are wise, Christina. She tensed against the feelings that rose in her at the sight of his smile. No, I'm very foolish. His gaze sharpened. And Diego, you lost him, too.
Yes, she said. And I had loved him. He was my first love.
But you don't love him now. His eyes had darkened, blue and gold, to a deeper black.
You shouldn't have to ask, she whispered. He reached for her. Her hair was down and loose, and he took a lock of it and wound it around his finger, his touch impossibly gentle.
I needed to know, he said. I needed to know if I could kiss you, and it would be all right.
She couldn't speak. She nodded, and he wound his hands into her hair, lifted a handful of strands to his face, and kissed them.
Lady of Roses, he whispered. Your hair, like black roses. I have been wanting you. Want me, then. Kiss me. Everything. Everything, Mark. Her thoughts dissolved as he leaned into her. When she murmured against his mouth, it was in Spanish. Bésame, Mark.
They sank backward into the sand, entwined, his hands running through her hair. His mouth was warm on hers and then hot, and the gentleness was gone, replaced by a fierce intensity. It was gorgeously like falling. He drew her under him, the sand cradling her body, and her hands ran over him, touching all the places she'd ached to touch, his hair, the arch of his back, the wings of his shoulder blades. He was already so much more present than he had been when he'd first come to the Institute, when he'd looked as if a high wind might blow him away. He'd gained weight,
put on muscle, and she enjoyed the solidity of him, the long, elegant muscles that curved along his spine, the breadth and warmth of his shoulders. She ran her hands up under his shirt where his skin was smooth and burning hot, and he gasped into her mouth. "Te adoro," he whispered, and she giggled. "Where did you learn that?" "I looked it up," he said, cupping the back of her neck, brushing kisses along her cheek, her jaw. "It's true. I adore you, Cristina Mendoza Rosales, daughter of mountains and roses." "I adore you, too," she whispered. "Even though your accent is terrible, I adore you, Mark Blackthorn, son of thorns." She smoothed her hand along his face and smiled. "Though you are not so prickly." "Would you rather I had a beard?" Mark teased, rubbing his cheek against hers. And she giggled and whispered to him that his shirt was buttoned wrong. "I can fix that," he said, and pulled it off. She heard some of the buttons pop and hoped it hadn't been a favorite shirt. She marveled at his lovely bare skin, flecked with scars. His eyes deepened in color. They were black as the depths of the ocean now, both the blue and the gold. "I love the way you look at me," he said. Both of them had stopped giggling. She ran the flat of her palms down his bare chest, his stomach, to the belt of his jeans, and he half-closed his eyes. His own hands went to the buttons that ran down the front of her dress. She continued to touch him as he undid them, neck to hem, until the dress fell away, and she was lying on it in only her bra and underwear. She would have expected to feel self-conscious. She always had with Diego. But Mark was looking at her as if he were stunned, as if he had unwrapped a present and found it to be the one thing he'd always wanted. "May I touch you?" he said. And when she said yes, he exhaled a shaky breath. He lowered himself slowly over her, kissing her mouth, and she wrapped her legs around his hips, the desert air on her bare skin like silk. He trailed a path of kisses down her throat. He kissed her where the wind touched her skin, on her belly and breasts, the peaks of her hips. By the time he slid back up her body to her mouth, she was shaking. "I want to touch him. I have to," she thought hazily. She slipped her hand down his body and under the waistband of his jeans. He inhaled sharply, murmuring between kisses for her not to stop. His body kept time with the movement of her hand, his hips pressing harder and harder against her, until he pulled away, sitting up, his breath coming in harsh gasps. "We have to stop, or it'll be over now," he said, sounding more human and less fairy than she remembered him ever sounding before. "You told me not to stop," she pointed out, smiling at him. "Did I?" he said, looking surprised. "I want it to be good for you too, Cristina," he said. "I don't know what you and Diego..." "We didn't," she interrupted. "I'm a virgin." "You are?" He looked absolutely shocked. "I wasn't ready," she said. "Now I'm ready. I just thought you'd been dating a long time." "Not all relationships are about sex," she said, and then wondered if making that statement while lying half-naked on a hill made it slightly more unconvincing. "People should only have sex if they want to." "And I do want to, with you." "And I want to with you," he said, his eyes softening. "But do you have the rune?" "The rune? The birth control rune?" Cristina had never put it on. She never thought she was that close to needing it. "Oh, no," she said. "Mastili is down in the institute." "Mine as well," he said. Cristina almost giggled at the disappointed look on his face, though she felt the same. "Still," he said, brightening, "there is much else I can do to make you feel good. Allow me?" Cristina settled back into the sand, feeling as if she might die from blushing. "All right." He came back into her arms, and they held each other and kissed through the night. And he touched her and showed her he did indeed know how to make her feel good. So good she shook in his arms and muffled her cries against his shoulder. And she did the same for him. And this time he didn't ask her to stop, but arched his back and cried out her name, whispering afterward that he adored her, that she made him feel whole. They decided to return to the Institute when dawn began to turn the sky rose-colored, and fingers of light illuminated their hilltop mesa. They wandered back down the path holding hands, and only unlinked their fingers when they reached the back door of the Institute. It stuck when Mark pushed on it, and he took his steely out to scrawl a quick open rune on the wood. It popped open, and he held it for Christina, who slipped past him into the entryway. She felt incredibly disheveled, with sand stuck to half her body and her hair a tangled mess. Mark didn't look much better, especially considering that most of the buttons had been ripped off his shirt. He smiled at her, a heart-meltingly sweet smile. "Tomorrow night..." "You have your steely," Christina said. He blinked. "What?" "You have your steely. You told me that you didn't, when I needed to make the birth control room. But you just used it to open the door." He glanced away from her, and any hope Christina had that he'd simply forgotten or been wrong vanished. "Christina, I just don't know why you lied to me," she said. She turned away from him and walked up the stairs that led to her room. Her body had been humming with happiness. Now she felt dazed and sticky and in need of a shower. She heard Mark call after her, but she didn't turn around. Diego was asleep and dreaming restlessly about pools of blue water in which a dead woman floated. So he was only a little bit upset to be woken up by the impact of a flying boot. He sat up, reaching automatically for the axe propped next to his bed. The next thing that hit him was a ball of socks, which didn't hurt, but was annoying. "What?" he sputtered. "What's going on?"
"Wake up," said Divya.
"By the angel, you snore like an outboard motor," she gestured at him. "Put your clothes on."
"Why?"
said Diego, in what he felt like was a very reasonable manner.
"They took Kieran," Divya said.
"Who took Kieran?" Diego was up, grabbing a sweater and jamming his feet into socks and boots.
"The cohort," Divya said.
She looked as if she'd just woken up herself. Her thick, dark hair was tangled, and she wore a gear jacket unbuttoned over her uniform.
"They burst into my room and grabbed him. We tried to fight them off, but there were too many."
Diego's heart raced. Kieran had been under his protection. If he was harmed, Diego would have failed. Not just Christina, but himself. He grabbed for his axe.
"Diego, stop," Divya said. "You can't axe Manuel to death. He's still a student."
"Fine, I'll take a shorter blade." Diego shoved the axe back against the wall with a clang and reached for a dagger.
"Where did they take Kieran?"
"The place of reflection. Or at least that's what they said," said Divya. "Rian's out looking for them. Come on."
Diego shook the last cobwebs of sleep from his head and bolted after Divya. They jogged down the corridors, calling for Rian.
"The place of reflection," said Diego. "That doesn't sound so bad. Is this a room for quiet meditation, or—"
"No, you don't understand. It's called the place of reflection because there's a reflecting pool in it. But it isn't a regular reflecting pool. Some people call it the hollow place."
"Oh." Diego did know of the hollow place. A secret room where, it was said, a pool had been filled with enchanted water. To gaze into the water was to gaze into your own soul. To see all the evil you had ever done, intentionally or otherwise.
"It's awful for anyone," said Divya. "And for someone in the Wild Hunt, it could kill them."
"What?" They turned a corner and encountered a blaze of light. It was Rayan, standing in the middle of a long corridor, wearing a grim expression. He had a massive sword strapped to his back.
They just went into the hollow place, he said. I couldn't follow them. I don't have my steely with me. Do either of you?
I do, said Diego, and they jogged down a short, sloping hallway to a set of closed doors. Loud giggles spilled out from inside the room. Diego scrawled a quick open rune on the door. It wrenched open with a puff of dust, and they charged inside. The hollow place was a wide space with granite floors, clear of any furniture. The walls were rough rock, glittering with mica. In the center of the room was a tile-lined pool with water so clear and clean it reflected like a mirror. Gold metal lettering decorated the floor. And God split open the hollow place, and water came out from it.
Well, thank the angel, drawled Manuel, who was leaning against the far wall in a pose of total disinterest. Look who's here to save us all. Zara giggled. She was surrounded by a group of other cohort members. Among them, Diego recognized several Scholomant students and their family members. Mallory Bridgestock and Milo Coldridge. Anoush Joshi, Divya's cousin. Several Centaurians were there too. Timothy Rockford, Samantha Larkspear, and Jessica Beauséjour was standing around smirking while Anoush dragged Kieran toward the pool in the center of the room. Kieran was jerking and twisting in his grip. There was blood on his face, his shirt.
It's a fair punishment for a princeling, don't you think? Said Zara. If you look or swim in the water of the pool, you feel the pain you've inflicted on others. So if he's innocent, should be just fine for him.
No one is that innocent, said Rian. The pool is to be used sparingly, to allow students to seek for truth within themselves, not as a torture device.
What an interesting thought, Rian, said Manuel. Thank you for sharing. But I don't see Gladstone running in here to stop us, do you? Is it possible you don't want to get in trouble for harboring a fairy fugitive?
I think it's interesting you know so much about Kieran, said Divya. Is it possible you knew he was here and didn't want to report it so you could torture and kill him yourself?
She was right, Diego thought. But none of this was helping Kieran, who was gagging and choking on his own blood. I swore I would protect him. Diego reached for his axe, only to realize it wasn't there. He saw Zara's eyes narrow and turned. Divya had yanked Rayan's sword from its scabbard and was pointing it at the cohort.
Enough, she said. Stop it, all of you. And I'm especially ashamed of you, Anoush, she added, shooting her cousin a dark look. You know what it's like to be treated unfairly, when your mother finds out.
Anoush let Kieran go with a shove. He landed at the edge of the pool with a grunt of agony. Move away from the water, Diego thought. But Kieran was clearly wounded. He knelt in place, dazed and gasping.
We're just having a little fun, protested Anoush. What are you going to do, Divya? Attack us? Said Samantha. Just for having a little fun?
He's bleeding, said Diego. That's more than just a little fun. And what happens if you kill him? Do you really want to deal with the consequences? He's the son of the Unseelie King.
There was a rumble of discontent among the cohort. Clearly, they'd never thought about that.
Fine, fine, said Zara. Be killjoys. But I knew he was here, hiding out in your room, she said to Diego. I saw the hollowed acorn on your floor, so this is your fault. If you hadn't brought him here, none of this would have happened.
Give it a rest, Zara, said Divya, still holding the sword levelly. Diego, go get Kieran.
Diego started across the room, just as Manuel finally spoke.
Why don't you just look into the water yourself, Rocio Rosales, he said. If you think your soul is so clean, it should be painless for you.
Cállate la pinche boca,
Diego snapped, nearly at Kieran's side. The fairy prince was coughing, blood on his lips. He started to pull himself upright when Manuel moved with the speed of a snake. Planting a boot in Kieran's back, he kicked him into the water. Diego lunged forward, catching at the back of Kieran's shirt, but not before Kieran had gotten a faceful of pool water.
Diego yanked him out, coughing and gasping, and tried to set him on his feet. Kieran staggered, and Rayon caught him.
"Just get out," Samantha said, striding toward them. "When the Inquisitor hears about this..."
"Samantha!"
Jessica called in alarm, but it was too late. Samantha had slipped on the water at the edge of the pool and tumbled in with a scream.
"By the angel," Divya lowered her sword, staring. "Is she?"
Samantha surfaced, screaming. It was a terrible scream, as if she were dying, or watching someone she loved die. It was a scream of horror and revulsion and misery. The cohort members stood stunned. Only a few moved toward Samantha. Hands reached into the water, grasped her arms, and drew her out. Kieran's hands. Still coughing blood, he deposited Samantha on the side of the pool. She rolled over, retching and gagging water, as Zara shoved herself between Samantha and the fairy prince.
"Get away from her!"
she snarled at Kieran. He turned and limped toward Diego. Diego caught Kieran as he nearly collapsed. The cohort was occupied with Samantha. There was no time to waste. As Diego hurried from the room, half supporting Kieran between himself and Rayon, Divya following with her sword, he was almost sure he could hear Manuel laughing.
"Okay," Julian said. "Let's see what we got." They were in what Emma could only describe as a glade. Glades were the sort of thing she didn't have a lot of experience with. There weren't too many in L.A., but this was definitely one, open and grassy, surrounded by trees, filled with sunlight and the low humming of what might have been insects or tiny pixies. You could never tell in Fairy. She was still dizzy from the trip through the fairy gate, buried deep in the woods of Brosselin Forest. How Horace had known about it, she couldn't guess. Perhaps it was information given to all high officials of the Clave. He had been impatient, nearly shoving them through without ceremony, but not too impatient to give Emma a medallion and both of them black rucksacks packed with weapons, gear, and food. The last thing he'd said was, "Remember, you're heading toward the Unseelie Court. Follow the map." A map wouldn't work in Fairy, Emma had thought, but Horace had shoved her toward the gate of twisted branches, and a moment later she was thudding to her knees on green grass, and the scent of fairy air was in her nose and mouth. She reached up a hand and touched the medallion. It didn't have an angel on it like Christina's. In fact, it looked as if it had once borne a Shadow Hunter family crest that had since been scratched away. Otherwise, it looked much like the Rosales necklace. It made a comforting weight at the base of her throat. "The Clave packed us sandwiches," Julian said, fishing around in his rucksack. "I guess for today, because they won't keep. There's cheese, bread, dried meat, and fruit, some bottles of water." Emma moved closer to him to see what he was unpacking and spreading on the grass. He'd taken out two gray blankets, an assortment of weapons, they also carried weapons on their belts, and folded clothes. When Julian shook them out, they turned out to be smooth linen in earth tones, fastened with laces and loops, no zippers or buttons.
"Fairy clothes," Emma said.
"It's a good idea," said Julian. Both outfits consisted of a long overshirt, trousers that laced up the front, and vests made of tough hide. "We should change. The longer we stand around in Shadowhunter gear, the longer we're a target." Emma took the smaller set of clothes and went behind a copse of trees to change. She wished she could have asked Julian to go with her, especially when she was hopping on one foot, pulling on her trousers with one hand while gripping her weapons belt with the other. She'd rarely felt more vulnerable to attack, but even though Julian had seen her with no clothes on at all, it felt awkward now. She wasn't sure how this new Julian, the one without feelings, would react, and wasn't sure she wanted to know. The fairy clothes were comfortable, at least, soft and loose. When she emerged from the trees, she stood blinking in the bright sunlight for a moment, looking at Julian. She saw him as he turned. He was holding up what looked like a piece of old parchment, frowning. He had put on fairy trousers, but he was naked from the waist up. Her stomach tightened. Emma had seen Julian shirtless at the beach plenty of times, but somehow this was different. Maybe because now she knew what it was like to run her hands over his shoulders, pale gold in the sunlight. He was smoothly muscled all over, the ridges in his abdomen sharply defined. She had kissed her way down that skin while he ran his hands through her hair, saying, "Emma, Emma," in the gentlest voice. Now she was staring like a curious onlooker. But she couldn't stop. There was something about it, illicit, nerve-wracking, as if Julian were a dangerous stranger. Her gaze slipped over him, his hair, soft, dark, and thick, curling where it touched the nape of his neck. His hips and collarbones made elegant arches under his skin. His runes described whorls and spirals across his chest and biceps. His Parabatai rune seemed to glow under the sun. Around his wrist was the same knotted rag of red-brown cloth. He looked up at that moment and saw her. He lowered the parchment he was holding, angling it to cover the thing on his wrist. "Come here," he said, "and look at the map," and turned away, reaching for his shirt. By the time she'd gotten near him, he'd pulled it on, and the rag was covered. He handed over the map, and she forgot everything else. She stared at it as he knelt down, unpacking the food from one of the rucksacks. The parchment showed a sketch of Faerie, the Thorn Mountains, various lakes and streams, and the courts of Seelie and Unseelie. It also showed a bright red dot that seemed to be trembling slightly, as if it weren't part of the page. "The dot is us," Julian said, putting out sandwiches. "I figured the map out. It shows where we are in relation to the courts. No real map would work here. The landscape of Faerie always shifts, and the Unseelie Court moves around. But since this shows where we are and where the Unseelie Court is, as long as we keep walking toward it, we should be all right." Emma sat down on the grass across from him and picked up a sandwich. They were both cheese, lettuce, and tomato, not her favorite, but she didn't care, since she was hungry enough to eat pretty much anything. "And what about Jason Clary? We said to Simon and Isabel that we'd look for them." "We only have 4 days," Julian said. "We have to find the Black Volume first, or Horace will destroy our lives. And the kids' lives. And Helen's and Aline's. And even Christina's. Because she knew our secret and she didn't tell." Emma knew it was all true, and Julian was being practical. Still, she wished he seemed more regretful that they couldn't look for their friends yet. "But we can look for them if we find the book," said Emma.
"If we still have time left on Horace's clock," said Julian, "I don't see why not."
4 days isn't that much time," said Emma. "Do you think this plan could work, or is Horace just trying to get us killed?"
"Be a pretty elaborate way to kill us," said Julian. He took a bite out of his sandwich and looked meditatively into the distance. "He wants the Black Volume. You heard him. I don't think he cares how he gets it, and we'll probably have to watch our step. But as long as we have it in our hands," he pointed at the map, "look, Brahm's Crossroads." The fact that their extraction point actually existed made Emma feel slightly better.
"I wish I knew what he was going to do with the Black Volume," Emma muttered.
"Probably nothing. He wants it so the fairies can't have it. It would be a political coup for him. The consul couldn't get it, now he does, and he gets to hold it up at the next council meeting and praise himself."
"He'll probably say Zara found it," Emma said, and then paused, staring at Julian. "You're eating lettuce," she said.
"Yes?"
He was leaning over the map, his fingers keeping it flat.
"You hate lettuce."
She thought of all the times he'd eaten lettuce in front of the kids to be a good example, and then complained to her later that it tasted like crunchy paper.
"You've always hated it."
"Have I?" He sounded puzzled. He rose to his feet, starting to gather up the things.
"We should head out. This time we travel by daylight. Too much weird stuff abroad in Faerie at night."
"It's just lettuce," Emma told herself. "Not that important." Still, she found herself biting her lip as she bent to pick up her rucksack. Julian was strapping his crossbow to his back. His rucksack went across the other shoulder.
seemed like an awkward arrangement to Emma, but... From the woods came a cracking noise, the kind a breaking branch might make. Emma whirled around, her hand at her hip, feeling for the hilt of a knife. Did you hear that? Julian tightened the strap of his crossbow. They stood there for long moments, on their guard. But there was no second sound, and nothing appeared. Emma wished fiercely for a vision or hearing rune. It could have been nothing, Julian said finally. And though Emma knew he wasn't really trying to comfort her, just trying to get them on the road, it still seemed like something that Julian she knew would say. In silence, they headed away from the clearing, which moments ago had been bright with sunlight and now seemed ominous and full of shadows. Chapter 8. Long Forgotten Bowers. Diana hurried toward the canal house on Princewater Street, the cool morning wind lifting her hair. She felt shot through with adrenaline, tense at the prospect of spilling her history to Emma and Jules. She'd kept it hugged so close to herself for so many years. Telling Gwyn had been like cracking open her ribs to show her heart. She hoped the second time would be easier. Emma and Julian loved her, she told herself. They would... She stopped dead, the heels of her boots clacking on the cobblestones. The cheerfully painted blue canal house rose in front of her, but it was surrounded by a ring of council guards. Not just council guards, in fact. Quite a few of them were young Centaurians. Each was armed with an oak bow staff. She glanced around. A few shadow hunters hurried by, none of them glancing at the house. She wondered how many of them knew Jules and Emma were even still in Alicante. But then the Inquisitor had planned to make an example of their testimony. They'd have to know eventually. At the top of the steps was Amelia Overbeck, who had been giggling with Zara at the funeral. Annoyance sped up Diana's stride, and she pushed past the first ring of guards and ascended the steps. Amelia, who had been leaning against the door talking to a girl with long orange-red hair, turned to Diana with a brittle smirk.
"Miss Rayburn," she said, "is there something you want?"
"I'd like to see Julian Blackthorne and Emma Carstairs," said Diana, keeping her voice as neutral as possible.
"Gosh," said Amelia, clearly enjoying herself, "I just don't think so."
"Amelia, I have every right," said Diana. "Let me by." Amelia slew her gaze toward the redhead.
"This is Diana Rayburn, Vanessa," she said. "She thinks she's very important."
"Vanessa Ashdown," Diana looked more closely. Cameron's cousin had left for the academy as a spindly teen and was almost unrecognizable now. "I know your cousin, Cameron." Vanessa rolled her eyes.
"He's boring. Emma's whipped puppy. And no, don't think you can get into the house by making nice to me. I don't like the Blackthorns or anyone who pals around with them."
"Great news, since you're supposed to be protecting them," said Diana. Her adrenaline was coiling into rage. "Look, I'm going to open this door. If you want to try to stop me..." "Diana!" Diana turned, pushing hair out of her face. Gia was standing outside the ring of guards, her hand raised as if in greeting.
"The consul?"
Vanessa's eyes bugged out.
Shut up, Vanessa," hissed Amelia.
She didn't look worried or afraid of Gia, just annoyed. Diana pushed her way down the steps to Gia's side. Gia wore a silk blouse and trousers, her hair held back with a jeweled clip. Her mouth was an angry slash.
"Don't bother," she said in a low voice, placing her hand on Diana's elbow and guiding her away from the crowd of hooting guards. "I heard them say Emma and Julian were with the Inquisitor."
"Well, why didn't they just tell me that?" Diana snapped, exasperated. She glanced back over her shoulder at Vanessa Ashdown, who was giggling.
"Vanessa Ashdown. My mother used to say some people had more hair than sense."
"She does seem to aptly prove that